I wish I could say there is a science of problem solving, and if you learn it, then you're in like Flynn, but unfortunately there isn't any science of problem solving. There is an art of problem solving, but like any other art, like potting or weaving or anything else, you only learn an art by doing it. And so if you want to be a good problem solver, the way you do it is just do lots and lots and lots and lots of problems. And eventually you learn how to do them and become good at it. There are some books on problem solving. George Polya has written several volumes over the years. But it's like a book on any other kind of art. If you read a book on potting, it may be very interesting, but that doesn't mean your fingers are any better when you're finished than when you started. It's the potting itself that makes you good at that art, and it's the same thing with problem solving. It's only the doing of it that makes you a good artist in that area. So there isn't any science of problem solving, and you develop the art only by doing the art. There isn't any one secret that anybody can reveal to you about how to do problems. However, there's one thing that I have found very useful. I'm not a terribly good problem solver. When someone reads to me a word problem, my first reaction is that my mind goes totally blank. And I say, oh my God, here I am a math teacher and I can't do this. And I've figured out that part of the reason my mind goes blank is that I'm trying to concentrate on two things at once, and your mind doesn't operate very well that way. And the two things that you're concerned about, on the one hand, you know there are some missing numbers, some quantities that you're supposed to find. And so you're thinking about those. What is the speed or what is the distance or something? On the other hand, your mind is also trying to look for some sort of equation or relationship among the various quantities that are involved in the problem. And if you try to concentrate on both things, you tend to get confused. So without an explicit plan for doing so, I've somehow arrived at a useful technique that helps me, namely to separate these two things, to look at one only and forget about the other one for the moment, and then I can concentrate on one thing. Let me give you an example. Suppose the problem is the following, and this is a typical artificial algebra problem. Bill buys a sailboat for $1,196, including a 4% sales tax. What was the cost of the boat itself? Well, the first thing you have to cope with is the fact that most math problems are very artificial. When you go into a store, you hardly ever see a sign that says the total cost is so many dollars, right? It looks bigger that way, so they always tell you the cost of the sailboat is, say, $500, and then you have to add the sales tax on to get the bigger figure. So it's a very artificial kind of problem. But when I see a problem like that, I know what I'm supposed to find, namely the cost of the boat, but I put that out of my mind for the time being and just think about the situation as it would be in real life and invent some numbers of my own in order to find out how the different numbers are related to each other. So I imagine myself, there it is on Monday morning, and I walk into this sailboat showroom, and the clerk comes up and says, good morning, Dunstan, how are you? And I say, George, good to see you. I want to buy a sailboat. And he says, here's a neat one over here. And I say, that looks dandy. I'll take it. How much is it? And there's a sign that says $500 for this boat. All right? I mean, that's a natural situation. It's unnatural in the sense that I've never bought a sailboat, never expect to, but I can imagine it anyway. So here's the sailboat, and it costs $500. And he says, remember, there's a 4% sales tax in this state. So I pull out my little handy pocket calculator, and I punch in $500 times 0.04 for 4%, and that turns out to be $20. So I've got $500 for the boat and $20 sales tax. It's obviously $520. Now, that's a real-life situation, and it doesn't cause any anxiety. You can easily imagine it. Just make up the numbers, any numbers, whatever. Now, once you've got that, you're beginning to see the relationship of the numbers. And that's half the problem. That's why people have trouble getting started, because they don't see how the numbers are related. So I can easily imagine that I've got the $500 plus the $20 for the tax equaling the total of $520. That's the boat. And that's the tax and that's the total. So that's easy enough to do. No problem whatever. And yet it shows me the pattern of relationships. So, well, if I go back to the original problem now, I may have the thing practically solved, or maybe not, but at least I've got a good start. I'm not sitting there with nothing on my paper saying I don't know how to get started. So I go back to the original problem, and it tells me that what the total cost is in the given problem. It doesn't tell me how much tax, however, and it doesn't tell me how much the boat cost, and so I've hit a little obstacle. It's a basic rule of problem solving that if you've got one equation, you can only afford to have one unknown number in there. Well, I've got two unknown numbers, the boat and the tax. So my equation is a good start, but it isn't going to carry me the whole way. So I've got to go back and rethink things a little bit. Where did these numbers come from? Well, I had to manufacture that $20 on my pocket calculator. So in effect, what I did was I knew the boat cost $500, and then I took my calculator and multiplied 0.04 times the 500. That's where I got the $20 sales tax from. And that adds up to the $520. Now I look at this new equation and compare it to what the original problem was. The original problem told me what the total was. It tells me how much the sales tax is. In fact, I'm using the same number, 0.04. The only other numbers in my equation are the 500s, and that's just one number. It's in two places, but it's just one number. So now I've got an equation that represents the kind of situation talked about in the original problem, and there's only one unknown thing in there compared to the original problem, namely the cost of the boat. So instead of using the word boat and the word tax, I'll write it with an X because that's a good taste in algebra. So in the original problem, I have some number X of dollars, which is the cost of the boat, plus 0.04 times X, the same number X, is equal to 1196, I think the original number was. So now I've got myself an equation, and that's two-thirds of the battle, getting yourself an equation. From this point on, it's just a matter of knowing some techniques, which we're not going to go into. You have to add up the X and the 0.04X, and that's 1.04X. Like one apple and 0.04 apples equals 1196, and you've got to divide both sides by 1.04, etc., and you come up with an answer. Well, those are just techniques. That's not the hard part. The hard part is getting started. So what I'm suggesting is that a useful technique in doing word problems or story problems, and I wish more students were told this, is to write yourself some statements, one or more equations that involve numbers that you've made up with no variables in them, and not the numbers in the original problem. Once you've got that down, it shows you how the different quantities are related. Then you can compare it to the original, and if you have only one unknown, you're in great shape. If it doesn't, you can massage it a little bit until you do. I found this very helpful. It's also a very good teaching device because students can follow your exposition of, suppose you walk in and spend, the boat costs $500. Well, the student has no trouble following that kind of explanation. So that's a useful hint in trying to solve the word problems. Invent your own numbers and work up something that makes sense and then compare it to the original problem. Very few people are able to look at a word problem and see immediately, this is the equation I want. The only people in the world who can do that are first-year algebra teachers because they do it all the time with students. And they're cheating. They're just remembering. Almost nobody else can write the thing instantly. Well, maybe some genius types can, but the rest of us can't. So it often helps them to use this numerical technique. Just write down a good equation. Okay, now it's time for a little exercise. This is a three-part exercise I'm going to ask you to do. I'm going to dictate to you, I'm going to say to you a little, very little problem I'd like you to do in your head. No pencil and paper. Okay, so the first stage is I'll give you 2 minutes to solve a very simple problem in your head. Then I'm going to ask you, first, what solution you got. Secondly, what method do you use? There's a basic rule in problem solving that any method that works is a good method. And probably you'll use several different methods. Fingers are all right, crochet needles, anything you want to use is fine. Then the third question I'll ask you is, did you notice any self-talk going on as you were solving the problem? What were the phrases floating through your head as you contemplated this problem? You don't have to answer if you don't want to. Some of the self-talk may be something you don't want to share with other people. Let these folks come in. We've just got to the point of the exercise. caught.
The volunteers, they volunteer
to do it. Okay, I'm going to give a small problem to do in your head and then ask for the solution, the method that you used, and any self-talk that went on the periphery of your consciousness as you did it. Okay, well, I think 2 minutes is plenty of time because it's a very simple problem. All right, suppose that this is the bicentennial year. It's 1976, all right? That's where we are, 1976. Suppose you've got a friend who's 39 years old and he's had his birthday already this year. He's 39 years old. In what year was he born? That's the problem.
by subtracting 39 from
76. How did you do that?
When you didn't have pencil paper? By visualizing it on a blackboard and carrying and subtracting. Mm-hmm. And then I proved it by adding 38 and 38. Because one of the numbers was
right.
One less and one was one.
You pushed one number up one and the other down one and they added them together to prove it. Okay, so that's one good way. It's just using, if your imagination is strong enough, you can actually see a blackboard like this and the numbers on it. Did you use a different method, Roger?
Yeah, I went from 39 to 40. I find it a lot easier to subtract that and then add one.
You subtracted 40 from 76?
Yeah.
And added
and then
one.
Add one.
Mm-hmm. Susan, did you do that or something else?
No, I did it the hard way, the way the man first
did it,
yeah.
On the blackboard? Mary, how did you do it?
I did it with 40.
With 40? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were there other methods for doing
it?
I wrote it on my Use your finger? The blue board and that's the pink board. Any other methods of solution? When I first
talk to myself a little, I said to myself, well, this isn't hard. When I figure my age, I do this, you know. And if my birthday hasn't been, why? So I did tell myself this much.
I'm trying to remember. I used a different method. We have two methods that were mentioned. I took 76 and pushed it up to 79. Because it was easy to subtract 39 from 79. And that got me 1940, but then I had already pushed it up 3 years, so I had to push it back 3 years. So that's at least three different methods that can be used. Jack?
I'll round both numbers, 76 to 75, and 39
to 40.
Yeah.
Then make two adjustments to
right.
it. All right, so that would be a fourth method for doing it. You'd probably find lots of other methods if you had to, you know, went around to enough people. Which illustrates the fact that different people do solve problems in very different ways. Some of them can be quite intricate, and it makes perfect sense to the person who does it. I mean, to you it may seem bizarre to push 76 up to 79, but that's instinctively what I thought of. It's not necessarily, in fact, it's probably less efficient than your method, of rounding 39 to 40. I have trouble visualizing a blackboard that clearly. If I really close my eyes, I can do it, but I have some trouble doing it. Yes, Dan?
I had a boy in my class, I teach fifth grade, I had a boy in my class 2 years ago who was graded as mentally retarded, and he was severely retarded, and also physically handicapped. And he could, he would ask you what your birthday is, September 7th, 1929. To tell you what day you were born. And he can do that, but you do that with anyone in class.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, do you know what, he didn't know how he did this. I asked him, how do you do that? He
said, what day of the week?
Yeah, what day of the week? Yes. Any year, any day. He just knew it instinctively. Now, either he learned a formula somewhere that worked, or he intuited.
It's a well-known phenomenon called idiosavant in France because there's so many of these people. And it's not only birthdays, it's the calculating geniuses can do the same thing. They're usually retarded adolescents who somehow can calculate, you know, 15-digit numbers times another 15-digit number and come up with the answer in about 2 seconds. And they cannot explain themselves
no,
how they do it.
I do it. It's easy. I explain it. You don't have to explain it. It's easy.
Some of them may have photographic memories. There was a young man in my neighborhood where I grew up who was retarded because he had rheumatic fever when he was an infant, and he had memorized the phone book. He could tell you your address and phone number if you gave him the name.
Is that something you spent a lot of time at?
Not that I know of. I suspect he probably had a photographic memory. He could just page through. I met someone once who had a photographic memory. He says it's extremely annoying. For one thing, it's very bad when you're in school because you rely on it, which means you don't really develop your mental powers very well. And secondly, it can keep you awake all night. Somebody says a word, you know, fudgicle or something, which you saw 15 years ago someplace, so you spend all night paging through pages and pages of stuff that you've got trying to locate that word. So it's not something to be sought after. Does anybody have any, is anybody willing to share any interesting self-talk, things that went through your head? You mentioned that you were sort of reassuring yourself that you knew how to do that problem.
I had a little bit of anxiety at the beginning because you complicated the issue talking about the bicentennial year. And that whole baloney. Uh-huh. A few seconds to get around that, uh-huh. Decide that had nothing to do with it.
But you're saying that dumb problem. That
yeah,
thing.
Another dumb problem.
Well, he already had his birthday, and I got to thinking, wait a minute, it would have been harder if he hadn't already had his birthday.
I first thought about changing both numbers, but then I got anxious and decided I'd get lost.
What worried me too is when you said this is simple.
Would you have felt better if I said it's a hard?
Yeah.
Hard
yeah.
Well,
you know, talking about this is simple. I don't know if any of you are acquainted with the book by Rob Weiss, The Haunted Hound. It's out of print right now, but. It's a book about a boy leaving school, failing in math. And he just can't get the story problem put together, mm-hmm. and all of this is going through his mind. And he runs away from home because he just can't face telling Dad he's got to go to, he failed math for summer school, so he's got to repeat the eighth grade. Anyway, he meets a fifth grade girl who used to have all this trouble with math, too, especially those dumb story problems.
Mm-hmm.
And until she started. She says, I never could see what an acre was. How do I know what an acre is? And she said, I finally started making my acres money in and out of my pocket. And she said, then it worked. She translated into something she dealt with. And it was just, it's a beautiful story
mm-hmm.
for anyone who says I can't do math. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry it's out of print. But
yeah. Jack, one reason I said it was simple was because I remember when I was in graduate school, we had it as an assignment to read a book called The Pygmalion Effect, which you may or may not remember. It came out of some experiments done in California where teachers told some children, the teachers were told that certain children were very gifted and that others were not. And in fact, that was not the case. It was fictitious. And this had a tremendous effect on the way the teachers taught and what the students did in response to it. So the teachers' expectations were important. And we had, the team that I was on had to give a report on this book to the rest of the class. So I wrote up a little learning package, just about 10 or 15 pages long, on writing Arabic script. And I got somebody to help with me, so it helped me since I don't know anything about Arabic script. And I divided my graduate class into three groups, and I told one group that this is a very hard learning module here, and another group that it was very easy, and another group that it was moderately hard. And then all three groups did the little learning module and took a test on it at the end, and by damn if the results didn't come out exactly that way. The groups I told it was very hard did the least well, and the medium group did medium, and the groups to whom I said it was easy did best. Well, that was a fluke. I mean, it shouldn't have happened statistically, but still it illustrated the point beautifully. So when I said it was easy, you know, I didn't want to burden your mind with an expectation that it was very hard. Maybe I should have said it was medium hard. Maybe that would have worked better.
Now we're not
going to
believe anything.
Smart. The next thing I want to deal with is the question of things changing in math. Students often hear from their teachers that one of the glorious things about mathematics is that words have only one meaning, unlike the rest of the sloppy world where words are always changing meanings and they have five or six meanings to start with. unlike that, in math, terms are technical and precise, and you always know where you are. That's not true. It's a bill of goods that teachers try to sell students to just to make them admire mathematics. Math obviously is different from ordinary language, but things do change in math, and if you're not aware of that, you're liable to get into trouble. One example is teaching multiplication to children. Typically, multiplication, when it's first introduced in, what is it, second or third grade, I've forgotten when, is presented as a form of repeated addition. You tell the students that 2 times 3 is just a shorthand for an addition problem. 2 times 3 really means you got a bunch of threes, namely 2 of them, and you're supposed to add them up and you get 6, and this is just a short way of doing it. 4 times 3, you got a bunch of threes, namely 4 of them, and you're supposed to add them up and you get 12, and so this is just a nice shortcut. Well, that's the typical way of presenting multiplication. It's a good way of doing it. I mean, it really does convey something to the student, so there's nothing wrong with doing it. The problem, however, is that there are two difficulties involved in it, and if you don't explain them to the student, the student may get in trouble later on. First of all, it doesn't work when you move from whole numbers to fractions. You've got to make a complete change in your thinking about what multiplication is. And if you don't warn students that the word multiplication is not a word with one fixed meaning, they may get very confused because they want to carry over the old meaning into a new situation where it's not applicable. And the second problem is that when you get used to doing multiplications with whole numbers, you build up the expectation that the answer is always bigger than either of the multipliers. And that's fine with counting numbers, but it's not true with fractions. That's one of the most frequently mentioned things in the articles I've read on math anxiety. People get hung up on fractions because the answer is not bigger in multiplication. This all comes from the fact that they started with one meaning for the word multiplication with its various implications, and they try to carry that through math, and you can't. And that's not unusual in math. Words have meanings in one context that are going to be junked, and they have to take on a new meaning in a different context. Obviously, the reason this approach to multiplication doesn't work with fractions is that if you get something like 1/5 times 3, if you tried to apply the old meaning, it would mean you got a bunch of threes, namely 1/5 of them. And that doesn't make any sense because you can't count with 1/5. And so you have to assign a whole new meaning to multiplication. The way I like to approach fractions, especially with adults, is to tell them to think of it, that horizontal bar as meaning the operation of division. Just as I suggested, separating the fraction into two parts when you're adding into, 4/3, like 4 oranges or something. If you have something like 1/3, think of that as 1/3. The reason for thinking of it that way is that when you get a complicated expression, this division sign then is just one more operation, and there's nothing mysterious about it. So if you have to multiply 1/3 times 12, that expression involves 2 operations, a multiplication and a division. And it doesn't make any difference which one you do first. So if it's convenient to divide the 3 into the 12 first, we'll do that. Just do whatever is convenient. You can't divide 3 into 1, as everybody knows, so divide 3 into 12. And you get 4, and then do the multiplication times 1, and you end up with 4. And if you have 2/3 times 12, it's the same thing. You've got 2 operations, a multiplication and a division. You want to do the multiplication first because you feel like that way this morning, that's fine. Do that, you get 24. Then divide by 3 and you get 8. Or if you're in a division mood, divide 3 into 12 first and get 4. And then multiply times 2 and you get 8. And if you have 2/3 times 10, and if you're in a division mood, you find that you can't divide 3 into 2 and you can't divide 3 into 10. Well, tough luck. Not all days are good days. But you can do the multiplication and you get 20. 2 times 10 or 20 divided by 3. You can't divide 3 into 20. It's all right. Nobody's going to beat on you. You just stop. That's all. If you can't divide, you can't. No need to apologize.
I have worked with a cross-section of children from kindergarten through high school, Title I math.
Mm-hmm.
Division is where I see all hang-ups.
Mm-hmm.
They can get through multiplication very well. in substituting now, when I get into whole numbers like this with fractions, I don't know how many junior highs, and this is where I basically service junior high math, getting them to put a 1 as a denominator under that whole number, and giving them the names of 1 are the secrets of changing from multiplication to division. And I can't believe teachers have not taken the time to give them all this identity element of multiplication, carrying the fractions, which is another set of numbers, technically.
Right. Yeah. It is a problem. One reason it's a problem, of course, is that there are so many particular rules you've got to master if you're really going to be good at it. But it's also inherently just kind of complicated. Division is a real bug. I mean, it's the hardest part of arithmetic.
Well, I found the time of one math in high school. As soon as we got to whole number division, those kids bombed. As soon as we got to our fractions, they bombed. We got through percent, decimals, they bombed. So when I got
when they get to division,
percentage,
yes.
I held them. Because they had everything there. But it was a ridiculous thing to watch them just totally lose interest whenever division, which is one of our most complicated processes, come.
Yeah. That's the next thing I'm going to talk about is division and the fact that it's a very complicated and artificial thing. One of the advantages of thinking of these numbers, the fractions, as being separate numbers with a division sign in there, is that when you come to multiply two fractions, again, you have two different operations going on. Multiplication tends to make things bigger. That's true. And division tends to make things smaller. And if you got to do both, Lord knows what the answer is going to be. So you don't come at it with the expectation that the answer is going to be bigger. It's obviously no predicting when you're doing both things in the same problem. As you were suggesting, division is generally one of the most difficult things. When I was in grade school, and the same is true for many of you, they taught us that marvelous algorithm or rule for doing long division. It's one of the most artificial things ever created. It sure is efficient, though. I mean, it works if you do it right. Long division, it always comes out. But it's extremely complicated. I think one of the reasons why we tend to get bogged down there, and there are probably some other reasons too, is that there are several different ways to define operations. And students are rarely told this because teachers don't reflect on it enough. One way to define an operation is a computational way. For instance, you can think of averaging as an operation, and you can define the average of two numbers x and y by a formula. You take x and you add it to y and you divide by 2. So that's one way to define an operation, by an explicit formula. The strong point of it is that all you have to do is take the two numbers, pop them in, turn the crank, and out comes the answer. So it is a computational formula. But there are other ways to define operations. For example, subtraction is usually defined, at least in an algebra course or anything beyond that, by saying A minus B is equal to C, if and only if, which is abbreviated IFF, in case you didn't know that, if and only if A is equal to B plus C. Now this is a totally different way to define an operation. It does not tell you how to find the answer. What it does is to give you a criterion for judging whether or not any number C is the right answer or not. So for instance, if you're supposed to subtract, say, 2 from 7, the definition says it will equal a number C if and only if 7 is equal to 2 plus C. So if I pick a number out of the air, say 10, and put it in there, then the answer to the subtraction problem is 10 if and only if 7 is equal to 2 plus 10. Well, this is false. If and only if means that the two equations will both be true or both be false. So if this one is false, this one is false, and I've decided that 10 is the wrong answer. And that's all this definition does for you. It gives you a way of judging whether or not any given number is the right answer. But it doesn't give you the slightest clue as to how to find the answer. Now that's the weak point, the weak aspect of this type of definition. I call it a yes or no definition, because it enables you to say, yes, this is the right answer, or no, this is not the right answer. So the weak part of it is that it doesn't tell you how to calculate. The strong part of it is that if you're doing theory, if you're trying to prove theorems, it's extremely efficient, because anything you want to know about this operation corresponds to something about this operation, because these equations always go together. So if you've already developed the theory of addition and have hundreds of theorems that you've worked out, and you ask the same questions about subtraction, any question about subtraction can immediately be turned into a question about addition, and you've already answered all those questions.
So it's neat from a theoretical point of view, and that's why definitions of that type are used. And division is defined the same way. A divided by B is equal to C if and only if A is equal to B times C. That's a beautiful definition to a theorist, because I don't have to prove many theorems then. I can just dump it all back into multiplication where I've already proved my theorems. Well, obviously that's neat for the theoretician, but it doesn't tell you how to divide. So you need another method or another definition for division. And you may remember many years ago when you were in grade school, they taught you this complicated thing. For instance, 468 divided by 12, you have to do a trial division, 12 into 46, and you get 3, and you multiply that times 12. And then you have to subtract and bring down. You're always bringing down things. And then another trial division, that gets to be a 9, and you multiply it out, and there's no remainder. Everything is dandy. It's very artificial, because you say, trial division, 12 into 46. Well, that isn't 46. You're just pretending it's 46. That 4 really means 400s, and the 6 really means 610s, or 60. So you're really dividing 12 into 460, but you pretend that it's 46. And then you subtract 36 from 46, only you're not really subtracting 36 from 46, you're really subtracting 360 from 460. So it's a very artificial algorithm. And that's one reason why it's hard to remember, because it's so artificial. And if you have more than, say, if you have 5 or 6 or 7 digits, the artificiality really gets excruciating.
Dunson, I think that's the easiest way to do it, and I learned the other way, where you make the line and write out the...
From the point of view of efficiency, you're absolutely right. There's no more efficient algorithm. People worked on this, I'm sure, for centuries. I can just see these little gnomes in their office writing away for centuries, working out this neat algorithm. It's terribly efficient. It does work. But it's also completely artificial. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't use it. That's the way I do it, too. If I have to do a division by hand, I do it that way. But it doesn't tell you what's actually going on. And there's some benefits in knowing what's really going on in there. If you forget this algorithm, if you forget even one step of it, you're up a creek, because it's so artificial. That's the trouble with artificial things. It's like breakfast this morning, someone was mentioning their... Jack, it was you talking about your $6,000 car wouldn't work because of a 35-cent part that was broken, right? One little thing goes wrong, zap, doesn't work. And that's true for artificial algorithms, that if you forget one part of it, you're absolutely stuck. Nothing you can do to recoup. Division really is a pain, and that's why people don't like it, why they forget the algorithm fairly quickly. Last spring, I went to the post office one day, and I was in a hurry in there. I took the shortest line. There were just two people in front of me. And the first person was fiddling around. Finally, she got finished. So I had just one person in front of me, a teenage girl, and she dropped a $10 bill on the counter and said to the clerk, "I want some stamps." So the clerk pulled out the folder of 15-cent stamps and then stopped because she realized she didn't know how many and said, "How many do you want?" And the girl said, "As many as I can get for $10. And the clerk was absolutely baffled. Yeah. No idea what to do. So she said, "Maybe that's about 30. So she pulled out a piece of paper and pencil, 30 times 15, that's $4, and that's not enough. Maybe it's 40, so she said, 40 times 15. There I am pulling my hair out, like, I'm in a hurry. So I finally pulled out a pencil and did a long division, right, the old-fashioned way, 0.15 into $10. So then I told her, it's so many stamps plus so much change, and she was so grateful. It's the only time I've ever determined what the U.S. Post Office was going to do. But I wasn't, in one way I was surprised, because I'm used to doing math, but another way I wasn't surprised, because division is the hard one. It's the thing people forget they don't like. I don't know if it helps, how much the modern math, quote unquote, helps. I've never really studied what they teach children in grade school, but I assume what they teach them is to break this thing into positional notation. 468 really means 400s. Plus 6 tens, plus 8 units. Our notation itself is very artificial because it's very abbreviated, unfortunately, because we can convey a large amount of information in a short space. The 4, 6, 8, the position of the digit means something as well as the digit itself. And so if you want to divide that by 12, you can think of it in a much more spread out fashion if you want. There's a theorem in math that says that if you have to divide the sum of several things, you can either add them all up first and get 468 and then divide by 12, Or you can divide 12 into each of the addends first and then add up the results, and you get the same answer. So if you think of it in the latter fashion and think of dividing 12 into each of these three things separately and then adding up the results, you get the same answer. Well, unfortunately, 12 doesn't divide into 4 and doesn't divide into 100 very readily. So you have to make a little switcheroo there. 4 hundreds is the same as 40 tens, right? 400 in either case. If you added the 40 tens to the 6 tens, that gives you 46 tens over 12 plus the 8 over 12. 12 doesn't go into 10, 12 doesn't go into 46, so you still haven't got a nice easy situation, but 46, if you think of 12 multiples of 12, 36 is a multiple of 12. So if you took 10 of these 10s out of there, you'd have 36 10s left over. Think of the 10 as an apple and the unit as an orange. All right, instead of having 46 apples, take 36 apples. Then you could divide by 12 nicely. So if I change that to 36 apples, that means I've taken 10 of those things out of there. 10 tens is 100 units. So I can combine that with the 8 units here, and that's 108 units. Now 12 goes into 36 very nicely, 3 times, and I have 3 tens. 12 goes into 108, 9, so I have 9 units. 3 tens is 30, and 9 units is 9, and 30 plus 9 is 39, and that was the answer. So that's what's really going on. I know.
All right.
It's only about 1/10 as efficient as the original algorithm.
May I interject? Yes. That in switching into the modern math of, quote, the 60s, which at that time the textbooks weren't the best written textbooks, and I worked with a math major who was also an elementary major on a 3-rotation process. These theories were all coming out to the children, and we could show them this, we could present it to them, and they'd get to their answer of 39. The next day you'd have to introduce the complete theory over.
Mm-hmm.
They could expand numbers, they could push them back together. The math major and I finally made the decision the only way they're ever going to do any of this is to start feeling confident that they can shove their pencils around,
mm-hmm,
and shove those numbers around and quit being afraid of them.
So what was the final decision about what do you teach them as a way
I
to do division?
You could theorize an awful lot and use all your time. Or you could get more practical and divide your time. And we decided finally to divide our time so that they would know how to compute time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's what I would do if I were in your shoes. I would explain this as a way of introducing the fact that they're going to learn an artificial algorithm. And if they want to reflect on what's actually going on, this is what's actually going on.
Because a high school algebra also reacts the same way to, mm-hmm, expanded numbers. What's it all for?
Mm-hmm.
And they understand it basically,
mm-hmm,
but I don't want to work that expanded out of line.
Mm-hmm. There is another side benefit to spending some time, and I'm not saying you should ignore the older method because it's the most efficient method there is. There's another benefit to doing this, namely if you get some practice in this business of positional notation. What does 4, 6, 8 mean? And it forces you to reflect on how we count with 10 digits. And the fact that that in itself is an artificial system. The only reason we use 10 digits probably is because we get 10 fingers. I mean, the word digit comes from the Latin word for finger. If we had only thumbs, we probably would use 2 digits. You know, mm-hmm. Just a matter of historical accident. And the fact in some cultures, they don't use 10 digits. But it's really neat if you're forced to reflect on how you actually count with 10 digits. It's as if you had a bunch of counters here, little dials, that like circles, like a hoop that had all 10 digits written on them. And when you count, what do? You start with all the dials set to 0. And when you count, you move this one up to 1, then to 2, then to 3. When you get to the last available digit, what do? You set it back to 0 and push this one up 1. And then you keep on going. Change this to 1, to 2, to 3, etc. When you get to the last available digit, you put it back to 0 and nudge this up 1. When you get to 99, you've come to the last available digit on both of these dials. What do? You set them both back to 0 and push the next dial up 1. And you just keep on going like that forever and ever. Now, there are two things going on here. First of all, you have a set of digits
10 of them from 0 to 9. Secondly, you have a system for pushing your dials up. You go through all the digits. When you get to the end, you set it back to 0 and nudge the next dial up 1. And when it gets to the last digit, you set it back to 0 and nudge the next one up a digit. Now, the system is independent of the fact that you have 10 digits. There are two separate things happening there. So if I started with only 2 digits, like the numbers 0 and 1, I could use the same system of dials, but I end up with very different results. I'd start off with everything set to 0. All right, first number, I change this to a 1. Second number, what happens? I've used up all my digits, so I set this back to 0 and push this one up to 1. So my numbers are running 0, 1, 1, 0. This corresponds to 1 in base 10. This corresponds to 3. 0, I add 1. That corresponds to 4. I've used up all of my digits in both places. What happens? I set them both to 0 and nudge this one up to a 1. Now I'm up to 1, 0, 0. That corresponds to the number 5. Push this one up to a 1. That's 1, 0, 1. I've used up all the digits here, set it back to 0, nudge this one up 1, I'm up to 110, and so on.
Is that what, did you see that Korean, it was on Good Morning America, this Korean man taught these children in New York?
Oh, yeah.
No, that's a different system. They use their fingers.
Yeah.
I never...
Incredibly difficult things. They just went like that and say, carrier computers, and they'd slap their hands.
I never heard the details of how that works. I don't know what it is. It wasn't exactly this. Anyway, this is obviously as legal a system as the system using 10 digits. In some ways it's inferior, because obviously it takes many more digits to convey a certain quantity. It took me 3 digits to convey a 7 instead of just a single one.
Do you have that?
Did I skip one? I may have skipped one.
Because 0 doesn't equal 1.
Oh, right. This should have been 0. Yeah.
Okay.
So the defect is that it takes an awful lot of digits to convey a quantity. The important thing about it, however, is that the two alternatives, 0 and 1, correspond very nicely to having electricity on or off. And that's what computers are based on. So this is a wonderful way of introducing computers. In a computer, you either have say in the old-fashioned system, you might have a vacuum tube that was either on or off. In modern systems, I think they use 2 different levels of voltage. Am I right? I'm not very good on hardware. So the 2 different levels of voltage can represent a 0 and a 1. So you can represent any number by a certain electrical arrangement. Now, in fact, they don't use the binary system directly. They combine it with a base 8 or a base 16 system in order to get to be able to handle large numbers. But this is what computers are based on. A different kind of numbering system. So there are advantages to getting into this, which is called the binary system, because it's an introduction to something that's important in the world now. Yeah, Jack.
This is a base 2?
This is a base 2, right.
It's an easy way for kids to understand. Mm-hmm. So it's surprising how quickly they can pick up on
sure.
binary number system.
Yeah, and in fact, you could construct a little dial, set of dials like that.
I have pictures in my mind. Mm-hmm. My cell phone is actually making the dials.
Mm-hmm. So they can push them.
I think any base introduction to a student really turns them on to our understand mm-hmm. base 10.
Right.
Because they go from any base to 10, mm-hmm. they clarify where they are with their own base.
Mm-hmm. And once you've got that, you can go on to something that's a little harder, like the hexadecimal system, where you have to invent some new digits. Instead of using only the digits, say, from 0 to 1 or 0 to 9,
right.
imagine there being 16 digits.
Yeah.
You'd have 0, 1, etc., up through 9, and then you have to invent some new ones, and they usually use the letters of the alphabet. Suppose you used 16 digits in your number system. That's called the hexadecimal system. And many computers actually code things by hexadecimal. So if this corresponds to the number 10, this means the number 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15. So then you'd have 16 things on your dial. And if you counted, you go all the way up to F, that would be the last available digit, set it back to 0, and move the next dial up. That's very handy, because 16 is a multiple of 2, and it makes it easier to code things that way.
Division with decimals is even more of a pain in the neck than division of whole numbers. And of course, the problem there is moving that old decimal point. That's a typical question I get from students who are coming back for a math refresher. Is this where I move the decimal? Again, they're trying to rely on their memory as to when you move decimals. Well, moving decimals is no particular charge or fun. The only reason you do it is because it makes life easier. If you go back to that definition of division, well, for example, suppose you want to divide, say, 0.15 into 9 or something. The definition of division was that A divided by B equals C, if and only if A is equal to B times C. Now, it happens to be true, and it's easy to prove, that when you're multiplying, looking at a multiplication situation, if I multiply B by 10, say, that multiplies the answer by 10. All right, if you double or triple or multiply one of the multipliers by 10, then the answer gets increased by the same factor. Or if I take 100B times C, that's going to give me 100 times A. That's easy enough to say. I mean, you're just throwing in another factor of 10 or 100 or whatnot. Well, correspondingly, then, in division, that must mean that 10A divided by B would equal, divided by 10B here. I'm just transferring the numbers from this equation to this one, would equal C. In other words, if I have a division problem and I multiply both the number to be divided and the divisor by 10, I don't change the answer any. Or 100 times A divided by 100 times B, I still get the same old answer, C, because that's the way the numbers are related. So in other words, given any division problem, I can multiply the dividend and the divisor by anything I want, and I'm not going to change the answer if I use the same multiplier in both cases. Well, it's a lot more convenient to get rid of decimals than to deal with them. So the only reason for moving a decimal point is to get rid of the blasted thing. So here I have 9 divided by 0.15, and I don't know what it's equal, but if I multiply both of them by 100, I get rid of this decimal point. I get 900 divided by 15 equals the same thing, whatever it is. So by multiplying both parts of the problem by 100, I've eliminated the decimal point. Now, I assume that I already know how to do this one, that I know how to divide 15 into 900. So what I've done is taken a new problem and reduced it to an old problem. Now, instead of actually saying multiply by 100, they teach you in school to move the decimal point, and then like that, like that. But moving the decimal point is just multiplying both the dividend and the divisor by some convenient number to get rid of the decimal point. The business of reducing a new problem to an old one leads to the old theory that the way you tell if a child is mathematically talented is that you take him into the kitchen and teach him to move a pan of water from the floor onto the stove. And once he's learned that, then you take and put the pan of water on a table at the opposite end of the room and say, put the water on the stove. If he's mathematically gifted, he will take the water from the table and first put it on the floor, then he will pick it up and put it on the stove. The reason is because he's reducing a new task to an old one, which he already knows how to do. Now, nobody's ever proved that that's really true, but it is the most typical way that mathematicians operate. Given a new situation, you try to reduce it to an old one that you know how to handle, and that's what you do when you move decimal points.
Constance, mm-hmm. What do you say when the kid asks you why go to the right of the decimal point two places you're in the tens column, but if you go to the left of the decimal point two places you're in the hundreds column, and what do you do when he asks that?
So say what the question is again.
Yeah, if you have the decimal point and you move it two places.
Like I have 0.15 here?
Uh-huh. If you go over two places, then he's in the hundreds. I mean, you know.
Well, what's in the hundreds place?
Well, you're multiplied times 100. Because if you go two places to the left, you're in the hundreds, right? Because it goes tens, hundreds to the left.
Oh, the one is.
It goes ones, tens, hundreds. And how do you explain that when you go that way, it's ones, tens, hundreds?
Oh.
I'm still not following your question. Are you?
Yes. See, we don't start with units on the on the left-hand side of the decimal, on the right-hand side.
Well, on the right-hand side of the decimal, right.
We don't have a unit song.
The easiest thing is to construct a kind of chart of what's happening. Essentially, what you've got is something like 10 to the third power. The next place is going to be 10 squared or hundreds. The next is 10 to the 1 power. It's kind of hard to say 10 to the 0 power, but that's in effect what you've got. And then you come up with 10 to the minus 1 power, which you won't understand, so you say the 1/10. So you go from thousands to hundreds to tens to units to tenths to hundredths. Better get right at this one. Right, because you're just going down by the... In other words, you take this, divide 10 to the third power by 10, and you get 10 squared, or 100. Divide 100 by 10, you get 10. Divide 10 by 10, you get 1. Divide 1 by 10, you get 1/10. You don't repeat the units over here.
No, I think that's a real confusion to students.
Mm-hmm. That it's a fixed sequence. Each time you divide by 10. Yeah. To get a kind of symmetry out of it. But there is, it isn't there. Mm-hmm. I think if you tell them about dividing each number by 10 to get the next one, you skip over that thing. The next point I want to talk about is more of a philosophical or psychological one than any particular math content. I think one of the problems that generates math anxiety is that when you do math, there are two very distinct attitudes or mental behaviors that you have to bring to it, and that until you're aware of that, you are liable to stick with only one of them, or maybe fall in between and do neither one very well. And the two attitudes are the following. On the one hand, sometimes in math, you have to act like a proofreader. You have to be very tightly focused and look at every jot and tittle. The comma's important, the dot over the I is important. Just like being a proofreader, you read backwards and forwards. Your eyes are very tightly focused on something. That's what I call the grungy side of mathematics, very highly focused. At other times, you've got to step back from the work and look at the broad picture to see the whole picture and the parts and how they contribute to the whole. And that's what I call the aesthetic side of mathematics. Sometimes, in this aesthetic side, it's very much like looking at a painting. When I go to a museum, I don't like to walk around a museum. I like to sit down in front of one painting that interests me and just sit there for about 10 minutes staring at it. And as you look at it, after a while, you suddenly realize it becomes clear to you that there's sort of a dividing line at the horizon, and the bottom half is the foreground, and the top part is the background. And you stare some more, and finally occurs to you that the colors are arranged in a certain way, that the blues and the purples are in the middle, and the oranges around the side, or something like that. And so you look in different dimensions, color, form, shape, position of the people who were in the picture. Each one of these dimensions, so to speak, gives you an arrangement of parts contributing to the whole, and you go back and forth from the parts to the whole. So you do that kind of thing in mathematics also. Well, the trouble is that people who are anxious often are not grungy enough when they ought to be grungy, and they're not aesthetic enough when they ought to be aesthetic. If you try being grungy when you should be aesthetic, you miss the whole picture, because you're too focused on some little detail and you don't see the beautiful sweep of a concept like group that I'll talk about in a moment. Or if you sit back and say, gee, that's a lovely thing, and you forget to put a plus sign in there, then you screwed it up also. So when you're being grungy, you've got to be very grungy, and when you're being aesthetic, you've got to be very aesthetic. Problem is to make it clear to students that there are these two moments, so to speak, in an alternating rhythm in mathematics, and you have to do both of them. Curiously, it corresponds to some articles I've read on brain research, you know, the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere. The left side of your brain apparently does the grungy part of your life. It looks at little details. It deals with grammar and, you know, very logical kinds of things. The right side is much more given to space perception, to seeing parts and holes and the broad sweep. So this is an analogy here, but maybe what I'm saying ultimately is that in doing math, you've got to use both halves of your brain. And sometimes it's important to use one side, and sometimes it's important to use the other side. I try to stress visualization when I teach math, because to me it just makes life so much easier. And I'm not sure whether sheer visualization, I guess that's part of the aesthetic side of it, just to see a nice image in your head. In one of the articles, they gave the following problem.
Bill eats 1/4 of a pizza. Susie eats half of what's left, and the remainder is given to the dog. How much does the dog get? All right. Well, you can solve that problem just by using your imagination. Here's the pizza here. I know Bill comes in, he cuts off a quarter, and that's his part. And then that leaves you, boom, 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 like that. And Susie comes in and eats half of that, so that means you got to draw a line at an angle here to slice off half of what's left here. So she gets that. How much is left for the dog? Well, it's got to go like this, around like that. Well, just by visualizing it clearly, you've solved the problem. It's somewhere between, it's more than a quarter because it slants, but it's less than a half because it doesn't go straight down, so it's somewhere between a quarter and a half. It turns out to be exactly 3/8. But the point is that the visualization makes it infinitely easier to solve the problem. Okay, one final point, and that will do us, except for any discussion you want to have. Math, to me, opens up new worlds, and I'm using the word world in a philosophic sense, meaning the reality that any individual happens to be dealing with at the moment. A one-year-old's world consists of a blanket and warmth and cold and wet diapers and bottle and, you know, a couple of other things. That's his world. My world at the moment is Holden, you folks in the dining hall and the pool hall and the mountains and the snow and so on. If you learn to play a new game like chess, that's a new world. The world of chess consists of some squares and pieces that move in funny ways, and that's the world of chess. When you do math, you have to move into new worlds where things behave in new ways that you've not seen before, and that can be a little spooky. Unless you're willing to see this new world on its own terms, you're liable to back away from it and say, no, I don't want to deal with that. I want something that's familiar. It's an old problem that occurs in many places. It certainly occurs in theology. It's much more comfortable to say, I know what justice means. Justice means such and such. God is just. Therefore, God is such and such. That's that. Don't tell me any different. It's very easy to do that, but it's bad theology. In theology, you've always got to be open for new worlds. Your concepts are constantly being pushed to expand. And it's scary. And the same is true in math. When you learn new areas of math, things behave in new fashions. The number two doesn't behave the way you're used to. And that can be a little frightening. So when you approach new math, you have to approach it with a kind of openness of mind to find out what's in this new world and not impose your own habits, your own familiarities on this world. And you may find it's not as bad as you thought. It may even turn out to be interesting. I think it's a pity when people write off math just because they've had some unhappy experiences. This is particularly a sore point when people are changing jobs in midlife. They have to think about a possible new career. I think it's a mistake to write off something that involves numbers just because, you know, numbers have not been your favorite thing in life. Who knows, if you go back to it as an adult, you might come away with a very different reaction to it and find that maybe it is to your liking. I just want to give one example of a kind of new world. Get a book here. Good old green hymnal here. I'm going to construct very quickly a new world for you in which things will behave somewhat differently. Here's this book. Suppose I think of doing a number of things. For instance, I can rotate it 1/4 of the way around so that the title reads that way. All right, that's a motion. Let's call that something. For instance, let's call that Q, like a quarter of a turn. If I start in the same beginning position, I can rotate it so that the title is facing away from me, half a turn. Let's call that motion H. Start from the same beginning position, I can turn it 3/4 of the way around so that the title reads that way. Call it, let's say, T for 3/4 of a turn. Or I can rotate all the way through a full circle back to where I started from. Let's call that F, say, for a full circle. All right, these are 4 motions that I can do with the book. Now I'm going to construct an operation. And by operation, I simply mean if I take these motions and do 2 of them in succession, that is equivalent to a single motion. For example, if I take the book and turn it 1/4 of a turn and then turn it another 1/4 of a turn, that's the same as a single motion of a half turn. Right?
doing two of them in succession is the same as a single motion. If I do a quarter turn followed by a half turn, that's the same as a three-quarter turn. A quarter turn followed by a three-quarter turn is the same as a single full turn. And a quarter turn followed by a full turn is the same as a quarter turn. You end up in the same position by a single motion. Now I can work through and fill out that table, which I'll do rapidly, and you can verify, if I don't make any mistakes, that it will look something like this. Now what I have done is I have defined a new mathematical operation. After all, what is an operation? It simply means you've got a set of things, for instance, in adding counting numbers, you've got a set of numbers, and you define some way that if you pick any two numbers, there's an answer to that combination of numbers. Well, that's what I've done. I've got a set of things here, Q, H, T, and F, which originally represented turns of the book, but it could be anything. And I've given you a way of deciding, given any two of these, what the answer is. The answer is the number in the box. And that's all an operation is, mathematically. A set of things and some way of determining for any pair of them what the answer is.